This time the court called 18-690-CR, Cedric Rashawn Green versus the state of Texas. What says the appellant?
Chris Waller from Mr. Cedric Green. You're on arrest for 15 minutes and 5 minute rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Waller.
And James O'Dell for the state.
Are you going to use all 20 minutes of your time, Mr. O'Dell? Or would you like to save all 20 minutes of your time?
I'll believe I'll probably use about 15 minutes and leave 5 for rebuttal.
You don't get any rebuttal, Mr. O'Dell. Only Mr. Waller gets last word of the day. So okay. We'll start your timer at 20. If we finish before that, you can give us back any time that's left on the clock. Can y'all see the clock, Mr. Waller, Mr. O'Dell, the timer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. All right, Mr. Waller, whenever you're ready to proceed on the Green case, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, concerning this case, I'd like to start off with clearing something up on my appeal where it was erroneous. I have stated in the appeal that the motion for a new trial was filed timely, and after a further review, it was not filed timely. We still got the motion and the exhibits in on the record on the clerk's report. However, that was an erroneous statement that I made on there that was filed timely, and I'd like to clear that up with the court and with counsel and apologize for that. I don't know how that happened, but I had stated that in my appeal, and that was incorrect. Now going forward concerning the appeal on Mr. Green, the crux of the entire appeal and the entire case is 39.14, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. The Michael Morton Act, what we've been hearing here. The insufficiency arguments are really directly related to the evidence that was left out in the trial that Mr. Manning had disclosed to all counsel after the trial was over. As indicated in the appeal and on the record, the trial ended, I believe, in December 11th. And then the email by Mr. Manning was sent out to all parties, those four different defendants with four different trials in this case. And a mass email was sent out to everybody on December 20th in the middle of the holidays, quite frankly. And then everything kind of got moving in late January as to what was going to happen on this case. Now the concern on the appeal in Mr. Green's trial is the due process argument and the constitutional argument concerning the Michael Morton Act, 39.14, which the state is supposed to turn over all discovery before trial if it's asked for. And simply they did not. The trial was a trial of where a accomplice testified, Mr. Randy Dorsey. He testified that he was there, and he gave all the testimony there, and the accomplice rule shows has to be corroborated. Well, the state used the data dump and the text messages and the Facebook posts taken from all of these telephones, which were numerous telephones, to corroborate everything that Mr. Dorsey was testifying to at the trial. There were pictures of a firearm. There are two separate pictures of two different firearms. One of the firearms was testified by Mr. Randy Dorsey to be the one that was carried by Mr. Green and the other individuals, and that was a picture that was on the phone. Furthermore, the state used evidence concerning text messages and maps and other pictures to corroborate the testimony on Mr. Dorsey. Now,
counsel, were any of those things discovered prior to trial, or were all these things that were things given to you after the trial and basically you had surprise at trial because of the documents that were given?
Well, Your Honor, here's the problem with that is that there was a data dump. To answer your question, I don't know. And that's a problem here is because it was a large data dump. There are a lot of pictures, and I believe those four or five different phones used in this data dump, where Detective Skeeter Upton had testified that he was in control of it, and he had turned it all over to the state. And the state relied on Detective Upton's testimony that that everything was turned over, and that the state had turned everything over to Mr. Stolle with the flash drive. That was the testimony. I will go to page 18 of my brief, of the appellant's brief, where the discussion was held there concerning the testimony there. Now, after the fact, after the trial, and after on the court reporter's record, where the email is attached on the motion for new trial, Mr. Manning was having a discussion with Detective Upton after the trial is over, discussing the other trial coming up. And he had asked him, is there any other information, to where Mr. Upton went back and he found information that he did not disclose to Mr. Manning. And he did not disclose, of course, to the defense, that could have been used in the trial. I don't know. Nobody knows whether this information could have been used. Now, if you look at the exhibit, there's pages and pages of a few pages of the evidence that was disclosed, but they're all in snippets and just in files to where you cannot open them. And since there wasn't a motion to new trial hearing, I don't know what was in those, and we couldn't get any meat out of any testimony from Mr. Upton. You will note in the court reporter's record that there is the email to everybody from Mr. Manning, and that's what I'm looking at right here, to where he has sent a mass email to all counsel in the trials during December 20th of that year. And then he had included a listing of files that were given to him. Now, these are just just kind of benign files, just showing that what a listing of the stuff was. There's no way to look into them to see what was inside those files. Now,
I have a question for you then. If yes. It was only those benign files that were left out, would you be taking the same position that that because everything wasn't turned over, he's entitled to a new trial? Or the question is, you don't know what was given at all.
The second part of your statement, Your Honor, is my position. The fact of the matter is that, I guess my verbiage is incorrect in saying they're benign. I do not know what is in these files. There are a whole bunch of data dump files that were included on here. I don't know how big they are. There is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 files, 3K. The size of them, 3K, one's a 16K size file that was included.
And Mr. Waller, my question is legally looking under the standard of review of Michael Morton, who is it incumbent upon to show that whatever the state did or did not include, whose burden is to show, hey, you dumped all this? Is it the state's to show, here it is in the data dump, or does the defendant have to show it's not included? Where does the burden lie, and where do we have to look to see whether the documents produced were included in that data dump?
Well, the way the law is structured is that the state is mandated, and the shall language in 39.14, that the state is mandated, and anybody who is contracted with the state, which includes law enforcement, is mandated to give everything over to the defense, whether they believe that it's relevant or not, other than work product, of course. That has to be given over to the defense in a practical manner, to where the defense could prepare for trial, quite frankly. Now, you give everything over, it's a burden on the state to give everything over, and they actually have a checklist where they check on every single thing they give over, and through affidavit form, they certify that they have given you every single thing that's in their file. Now, it's a burden on the state to work with their prosecution team, because they have victim coordinators, they have law enforcement, they have lab technicians, they have experts that they need to work with, and they need to get all that information to give it together to the defense, and the defense works on it.
But Mr. Waller, if you're telling this court that you don't know whether it's included or not, that's my issue. How do we go back? Because the state will go and say, well, it's there. And you say, well, I don't know if it's there. So how do we ascertain from an appellate review whether the proper documents were given to you as required by law?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand now. Thank you. This information that was given after the trial over was not included in the discovery before trial. That is attested to through the email that was sent out by Mr. Manning after the trial was over, and he listed the data dumps and the documents or whatever was there. He listed those as not being part of the discovery that was given to the state. Also within the trial, Reporter's Record, Volume 13, page 258, lines 9 through 17, there was a discussion concerning that because Mr. Stolle had objected, because Detective Upton was testifying as to the information that he had found on the phones, and Mr. Stolle had objected because these are not items that I was given in discovery. So he had caught that he had not seen this information. Then the court had a hearing. They allowed Mr. Upton to check his records, and then he checked him. He said, no, I gave everything over. And then Mr. Manning essentially stated that if he gave us everything, then we gave everything to the defense. Then the trial went on, and Mr. Green was found guilty, of course, with that information, because it was contested. Judge Watts had the hearing, and she got everybody under oath to make sure that she felt that all the information had been given over, because she had held the evidence out until she was satisfied that the information had been given up. And then
let me ask you, we won't talk about every piece of evidence, but for instance, the gun, you're saying that the trial lawyer, when it was presented at trial, said that picture of that gun was never given to me.
No, that is not the piece of evidence that I believe he was alluding to. The gun was in the evidence, but there is other text messages.
The picture of the gun.
Yeah, the picture of the gun was included in the discovery pack. I'm pretty sure it was. That's not the issue. The issue is that the issue that I'm arguing here is that 3914 says that you have to give everything over, because if you don't give everything over, the defense does not have the opportunity to use whatever information was not given to them to defend themselves. I don't know what's in there. There could be a text message that states, "Hey, I'm the one who shot everybody, and CJ Green had nothing to do with it." We don't know that, because that was not disclosed to the defense, and that's fundamentally unfair and is a violation of due process, and it is a violation of 39.14.
So do we still not know what was in the material that was given after trial?
We do not know what was in the material that was given after trial. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I thought there was a data dump where basically you were given all the information, albeit after trial. Is that not correct?
After trial, we were given a list of files that were not disclosed to the defense. That's all.
Trying to find what those files were and actually look at them in the record.
I did not get those, Your Honor. I'm sure other trial counsel on the other trials that came after Cedric Green got them. But as for myself and for Cedric Dream's case, we did not get to look into those files.
Is there any harm?
Here's Sorry, go ahead, Ms.
Is there any burden to look at the particular documents for the purpose of relevance, materiality, and I guess in Jaime's words, whether they were benign to the
Well, trial? If it was just a Brady argument, then yes. But this is a 39.14 Michael Morton argument to where the defense, Mr. Green is supposed to get these documents via due process. He's supposed to get them so before trial so that he can prepare for trial and see whether there's anything on there. Now, the burden's on the state if there's any exculpatory evidence to let us know what the exculpatory evidence is. However, they are supposed to give us all of the evidence, and they didn't, and they did not. So the danger here and the harm here is that we don't know, and that's the problem, is that we're supposed to know everything that's in there, whether it's material or not, so that we can use in our defense. Because there could be some gems in there, there could be not. But the problem is, for due process claims, we're entitled to it, and the state did not give it to us, and they admitted that they did not give it to us after the trial was over. So I understand the argument concerning what to show harm and stuff like that, but in this case, it's distinguishable because we're actually entitled to all that information, and the state violated that law by not giving it to us, and which was a violation of due process in that regard. Especially it makes it more egregious, is that there was a hearing out of the presence of the jury during trial on a timely made objection, to where the detective who was in control of that evidence testified under oath that he gave everything over. And then we come to find out after the fact, only upon Mr. Manning inquiring about it, that it was found that that evidence had not been given over. There was a discussion that I think Mr. Manning said that it's all substantially the same, but we don't know that because we never had a chance to look at it. And that's the problem here, is that we never got a chance to look at the discovery that we were actually entitled to.
Okay. Is there any further questions? If not, Mr. Waller, your first 12 minutes are up. For those who are watching and noted, I wanted to note it on the record, your clock did not start at 12 minutes, Mr. Waller, but I've got a text from my IT people that they checked with the recording and you were allotted your whole 12 minutes during that argument, okay? So if you go back and look at the video, it's gonna, the 12 minutes didn't start on time, but you were given your full 12 minutes. On that time. All right, Judge, Mr. O'Dell.
Judge, I'm sorry to interrupt. It was actually a 15-minute timer.
So I'm sorry, a 15-minute timer. Sorry. It stopped at 12 or it started at 12 or something like that. I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that we didn't short you any time or give you any extra time, Mr. Waller. And
yes,
if you needed more time, we would have allotted it. All right?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Mills. Mr. O'Dell, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. James O'Dell for the state. May it please the court, counsel. Green's third issue for review, he complained that he was denied a fair trial under 3914 in the Michael Morton Act. And in my brief, I argued that his motion for new trial was untimely. And that does mean that the arguments and supporting evidence with that are not substantively in the record before the court today. And I'd like to expound on that a little bit. I don't know if it's even necessary, but there is some precedent in the 13th court for this. And at this time, the state is moving for the court to strike the supplemental clerk's record, which contains the untimely filed motion for new trial and the accompanying evidence. And
Mr. O'Dell,
Your Honor.
We don't do verbal motions, unfortunately, at the appellate court. So if you want any kind of relief, a written motion will have to be filed, and you can file it after oral argument. And Mr. Waller will have an opportunity to respond.
I appreciate that, Judge. Even without the motion, it is the law that the court not consider any documents or arguments filed with an untimely motion for new trial. According to the rules, the motion for new trial has to be filed within 30 days of the sentence being handed down in open court. Mr. Waller has conceded that that wasn't done in this case. And because he filed the motion for new trial on February 15th, 2019, whereas the trial court handed down sentence December 11th, 2018. So this evidence, while physically a part of the clerk's record today, is not properly before the court, and the accompanying evidence shouldn't be considered. And that's been the law for years now, and it's been followed in the 13th court as well. And so without that evidence to be considered, then there's nothing for the appellate court to pass on. That's the legal reasoning. Yes, Your Honor.
So, Mr. O'Dell, what you're arguing is that without the supplemental record that includes the email from Mr. Manning, there's nothing to indicate that evidence was withheld from...
That's correct, Your Honor. And more importantly, there's nothing for the appellate court to look at to be able to answer the ultimate question, which is, and I think Michael Morton expands 3914, it doesn't replace it. So you do have materiality. I'm considering Waller's argument to be both the materiality under 3914, but also, whether the evidence could negate his guilt or even mitigate his punishment in any way, which is that's the standard under Morton. And how do we say if it does or not? And because, ultimately we're talking about evidence that hasn't been vetted by the trial court in a proper fact-finding procedure or otherwise. And frankly, you can tell. Maybe we don't know the import of the evidence because it hasn't been explored. And kind of that's the problem. Because, from looking at the evidence that's attached to the untimely motion for new trial, which is the only evidence that's before the court today, I have to say it's largely indecipherable. If the court had to pass on that as it stands today, I don't really know what to make of it, but I don't see anything there that's material or negates his guilt or could mitigate.
Well, Mr. Waller seems to argue that it doesn't matter whether it's relevant or benign or pertinent, or the mere fact that we know that evidence was not turned over, or materials, it doesn't even need to be evidence, whatever it is, wasn't turned over, is sufficient to cause a violation of due process and a violation of 39.14.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that. 39.14 in black, in the statute, it says, prior to the passing of the Michael Morton Act, there was a materiality requirement. Then even after the passing of the Michael Morton Act, the plain language of the statute says that it either needs to be evidence that negates guilt or mitigates punishment. And that's the problem, is I can't tell, and I don't know if the court can tell, but I can't see anything in the document that's attached to his untimely motion for new trial that meets that standard. And
So whose burden is it, which just goes back to my question to Mr. Waller, whose burden is it to advise the court that whatever material was not disclosed is material, that the material given is material? Is it incumbent upon the defendant to say they didn't turn this over, and this, let's for example, hypothetically say, this email I could have used to impeach the credibility of the accomplice testimony, because that's what the big deal is here, is that this evidence was the only evidence that corroborated an accomplice testimony. There was no direct evidence of the guilt of Mr. Green other than the accomplice, but you need at least a little bit under the law. So whose burden is to show, well, the defendant needs to show this, I would have used this email, or is it incumbent upon the state to say, this all material is all just kind of, it doesn't have anything to do with why we're here today?
Yeah, I think it's the appellant's burden, in fact. I think he has to show, he makes the argument, and he has to show that the evidence was material. I think it's his burden of proof. And as I was saying, I'm not sure that with the evidence that's now before the court, that any evaluation could be made in either case, whether it was the state's burden or his, because and you know, maybe the appellate court isn't the proper vehicle to vet this evidence. But there's still the opportunity for Mr. Green to file habeas petitions under Article 1107, in which case I can think of at least three or four different grounds for relief that he could argue to the Court of Criminal Appeals based on this evidence. But the problem is that in the trial court, at least, if the motion for new trial had been timely, and also in the case if it goes up on habeas petition, in both those situations, the trial court can call witnesses, it can admit new evidence into the case, it can see exactly what's in, you know, the data dump, aside from, you know, what we know is before the court today, which is, you know, five or six pages of phone numbers and you know, nothing of any real value. And that's my point. That's the, you know, the law says that the court shouldn't consider anything that's not substantively part of the appellate record. And because this was filed in a late untimely motion for a new trial, and because it was never presented to the trial court so that the trial court could have a fact-finding mission to discover the import of the evidence, then there's nothing before the court today to pass on the question of whether that's materiality or whether it negates guilt or whether it could be used in mitigation of punishment.
Any questions?
No. Okay. None. So Mr. Waller didn't go into any other facts of the case, and if it pleases the court, I will, or I will give back my time and answer any other questions that the court might have. So I'll go on with the other issues that he presented. Yeah. So in his first two issues, he presents both legal and factual sufficiency arguments, which the court is well aware has been consolidated under Jackson v. Virginia. So, but there is, I thought that there was a really interesting question raised by those two issues too, which was, it actually is two issues, but not factual legal sufficiency, but what I'll call the constitutionally principled question, and then what I'll call the statutorily principled question. So constitutionally principled question is the sufficiency review under Jackson v. Virginia. But there's also the statutorily imposed review of the corroborating evidence for the accomplice witness testimony. And he did make the argument in his brief that both his murder convictions and his conviction for organized criminal activity were based upon uncorroborated accomplice witness testimony, and that's simply not true. And I will say before I go into that, just to take a step back, he said that there was an argument made to the trial court at trial by counsel for the defense, Mark Stoley, where he said that, you know, that the witness was testifying to evidence that he didn't have. But the issue there, and it was resolved at the trial court level, was that he had that evidence, but it just hadn't been printed out. So he had the zip drive with all the evidence on it. And Mr. Stoley said that he was satisfied with it. So I don't know how that supports the claim that about the withheld evidence either. But anyway,
question is, what corroborating evidence did you have that links Mr. Green, that isn't in any way related back to the accomplice testimony? Because we all know you just can't be convicted over an accomplice testimony. So what do we have that directly relates them back to this crime that isn't associated to this accomplice?
Right. Well, you have a couple of different things that you have to do. First, you have is the corroborating evidence can verify the testimony of the accomplice. So if it does that, it's corroborating. You also have accumulation of suspicious circumstances, which nothing by itself has to directly link him to the offense or show guilt. But together, the weight of the evidence supports the accomplice testimony. And here we have quite a wealth of testimony and evidence, video surveillance, and even an interview with Green done with the police, where just like Randy Dorsey was the accomplice in this case, and just like he testified before the court, this other evidence also showed that Green was a drug dealer. He drove a white Cadillac. Chloe was his girlfriend and accomplice. The day she was murdered, the victim bought drugs from Green. And after he left, he discovered his property was missing. He enlisted the aid of his other accomplices, Jace Montaigne and Randy Dorsey, to help him find the thief. First, they visited a few folks in his apartments, quizzed them about the missing money. It's notable that he didn't mention his missing gun at that time. After this, they went out looking and they discovered that the victim had cashed in a roll of coins that had been stolen at the local church's chicken. Sometime later, a homeowner on a secluded ranch in Robstown heard multiple gunshots, and the victim stumbled up on her porch and collapsed, saying, "They tried to kill me." The victim had multiple gunshot wounds, one to the front of the body and the rest to her back. She had cactus spines and scrapes and cuts from running through the brush for the brush. And the police were able to recover 9mm bullet casings. And the bullets recovered from the victim were also 9mm caliber and all fired from the same weapon. Now, later on, Green was arrested. He was arrested. And in his interview with police, he bragged about how smart he was and all the harm that he would do to somebody who ever stole from him. He admitted that the gold and silver plated 9mm handgun was his. But now, for the first time, he claimed that it was stolen along with the money, which I said was notable because when he quizzed the people in his apartment about the cash, he never mentioned, "Where's my gun?" So the murder weapon was conveniently lost. He admitted that he was drug dealing and that Randy and Chloe were his associates. He admitted that morning the victim came and bought drugs from him the day she was murdered. He admitted to searching for the stolen money and finding out the victim did it. He denied knowing Jace Montaigne, but eventually when he was confronted with evidence of both of them together, he had to admit, "Okay, yeah, I know him." He admitted to the arrangement for Jace Montaigne to have sex for money with the victim, which was the ruse that Mr. Dorsey had pointed out was used to lure the victim into the car to get her out to the secluded place to murder her. He even admitted that later that day, he and his accomplices went to his sister's house, which, if you'll recall, Mr. Dorsey's testimony was that, yeah, after we ditched the gun in the bay, we went to his sister's house and burned all her clothes to get rid of all the evidence. And then the police searched his cell phone and they found a text messages between him and his erstwhile wife, where they basically talk about the murder. They talk about, the conversation was about Chloe, which, if you'll remember from Randy Dorsey's testimony, she's the one that fired the first shot after Green loaded one bullet into the gold and silver handgun and handed it to her. She fired one shot into the front of the victim. The victim took off running through the brush. He put the magazine into the gun and slid the slide home and handed it to Jason, said, "Finish the job." And he shot her. He unloaded the clip into her back as she ran through the brush. So in his conversation with his erstwhile wife, they had a conversation about Chloe, and Green was explaining to LaToya Davis how she needed to be protected because he had got her into this. LaToya disagreed, saying that, you know, it was her choice and that she was just trying to impress Green by being gangsta. And at that point, Green warned her she'd better keep her mouth shut. Under the law, you've got, in this case, you've got association with the accomplices before and after at least the murder, if not during, but we've got a motive to kill the victim. We've got the opportunity and the setup, the sex for money, luring her in, the influence to get his associates to help her, help get her out to the country to murder her. By his own admission, he was with them, and the text conversation with his wife was certainly suspicious, as was the sudden disappearance of the gun and it showing up on the list of stolen property once he spoke with police. And all of this non-accomplice evidence perfectly verifies Randy Dorsey's description of events. The answer to the statutorily principled question, as I put it, is that the accomplice witness evidence was sufficiently corroborated. Now, going back to the Jackson v. Virginia standard, I think that's the simpler question because accomplice witness testimony alone can be sufficient under Jackson v. Virginia. And as I said, Randy Dorsey's testimony before the court mirrors exactly the non-accomplice testimony. From the drug dealing, the stolen money, the search and discovery for the thief, the hatched plan to lure in with a promise of pay for sex, taking her out to the country and Chloe firing the first shot, Jace firing the rest. The first bullet was in the front, found by Dr. Fernandez to be placed in the front of the body, where the rest were in the back. The cactus spines and scrapes from running through the brush. And then he testified that they went and they took the gun apart and threw it into the bay and then headed to his sister's and burned all their clothes and her barbecue pit. So that testimony by itself was sufficient under Jackson v. Virginia. And in summary, under his first two issues, the combined weight of the non-accomplice with testimony was more than enough to meet what the courts have deemed a very low threshold to provide simply provide facts that tend to connect the defendant to the offense. And with that, I think that the court should overrule Mr. Green's appellate issues and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you, Mr. O'Dell. Any questions, Justice Burke, Justice Tejedina? All right. Mr. Waller, we'll reset the clock for you, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Waller, you can start whenever you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Concerning going back to the 39.14 issue, it is a constitutional issue, a right to fair trial. And it's a very important right that all accused citizens do have. And that right is also backed up by 39.14, the Michael Morton Act, and also Brady. Because in the past, what's been going on is that the state government and all of the people who work with it have been holding back evidence throughout history. I mean, that's why Michael Morton was passed individually due to that instance. And that's why it's very important constitutionally that some teeth be placed into that statute to where everybody who's a government actor has to follow the law and follow the due process concerns that support
Mr. Waller, do we have enough in this record assuming for the sake of argument that the supplemental record is not included in our appellate review, which is what we're bound by, is there enough to, without that supplemental record, to ascertain that there has been a Michael Morton violation or a Brady violation or a 3914 or even a basic constitutional violation, because not everything was turned over?
There's nothing in the record without the supplemental clerk's record to indicate any of that, Your Honor. It's just a trial record. And again, to really push this point, is that this information was not given until after trial, December 20th, during the holidays. That's when this information was given out by Mr. Manning. And it was information that was associated with Detective Skeeter Upton's testimony. Detective Skeeter Upton testified showing pictures of two separate firearms, showing charts as to timelines that were included on pings on the cell phones. He testified that he associated phone numbers and social media accounts with Cedric Green. That was in volume 13. He testified that he had analyzed the information targeting Cedric Green all throughout his testimony, and also showing the text messages and items like that on the phones. So what it comes down to is this. There was a violation. Absolutely. The state violated 39.14 by not giving over constitutionally mandated evidence. That's clear. And that's what happened in this case. And that evidence was used to convict Mr. Green. It was very telling during the trial, and some of the evidence was left out, which the state is mandated to turn over. Now,
counsel,
again,
yes, Your Honor. You know, basically one of the propositions on preservation of error is that even constitutional issues can be waived by not timely presenting them. And that's the concern I have here. Is the appeal at this point really the proper remedy, as opposed to a habeas corpus situation where they can actually hash out the evidence and know what was actually deleted from the record or kept from the record?
Well, I'm thinking that all courts have the duty, Your Honor, to protect the Constitution. And this is clearly a constitutional issue, the right to a fair trial. And that's why we're here. And the record is in front of you. It's part of the record showing that this violation occurred. And it's in the clerk's record. It is certified. The court has it in front of the court to look over. And I think for constitutional reasons, it should be looked at and taken into account. I don't believe we have the burden to show materiality, because it is a clear violation of 39.14, and is even an admitted violation once you read the email by Mr. Manning that this information was not turned over, which is very important because we want to have fair trials. That's what we want to do as a justice system. That's why we have the justice system. And we want to have fair trials and make sure everything is done correctly. And that is the point here, Your Honor.
All right. That is all the time. The case will be under submission at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Waller.
Thank you.